Oh, hey there, listeners and juicers. Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that if you have fallen in love with the Draw Your Dice podcast and want to help put some new fruit on the table, but don't feel comfortable making a monthly commitment, well, you can support the show via the Acast supporter feature. No gift too large, nor too small. Just click on the link in the show description and know that I am sending you the strongest hug when you do so.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Our relationship to our past, or the image of our past, has been so abridged because of, you know, part of the nationalist project is to have a sort of mythologize and homogenize your nation's past. So to give the reason for the nation to be. So
my name is Jeremy Gage, and welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast. This is an educational show involving all things tabletop role-playing industry. Listen alongside me as we hear from creators, entrepreneurs, and supporters about their personal best practices, principles, and philosophies. I encourage anyone from the budding game designer to a seasoned publisher and everyone in between to sit down with us and enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming to the Draw Your Dice podcast. My name is Jeremy Gage, as you heard in the intro. But as always, the show is never about me. It is about who I have brought to you today. And I have brought another international guest from across the globe. This person is one piece of Centaur Games. They have a Kickstarter coming around the horizon, Reach of the Roach God. I would like to welcome to the show Zedek.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks for being here. As an opener to the show, would you just give a brief introduction of who you are, how you present yourself to the internet, and any link so that people can go check out your stuff / give you money as soon as possible?
Sure. So I'm Zedek Siu. I'm writer, designer, translator based in Port Dickson, Malaysia. And with the visual artist Mankau, we make a series of RPG zines called Thousand Thousand Islands. I can be found on Twitter at ZXU, and we have a website, 1000000islands.com. And yeah.
Amazing. Great. Additionally, would you also sort of walk us through the lineage of your tabletop experience? Sort of like, what was the first game you played that kind of got you into the hobby? And then what was the first idea that got you designing?
So my first game was pretty conventional. So I started playing when the fifth edition of Dungeons & Dragons came out. In fact, I started playing with Mankau. So we'd been interested in tabletop role-playing games separately for quite a few years, but it was more of like, hey, there's these things, and like there are these cool books with cool art and like interesting like writing and settings and stuff. But it wasn't until one of our other friends, and so we me and Manka were both part of like a sort of arts community in Kuala Lumpur, which is Malaysia's capital. And so that's how I know him. And we weren't friends through gaming, if you see what I mean. And it wasn't until one of our other friends said, hey, I used to play Dungeons & Dragons in university, and they have a new edition out. So are you guys interested? So yeah, I mean, that was basically our first time playing. And so it's serendipitous or full circle in the sense that me, Mankau, and also Grace, who is also helping us on our Kickstarter project, our upcoming Kickstarter project, that all three of us were part of that same campaign. Yeah, I guess this is in terms of actually making things. I can cite two things quite specifically. One was finding a blog by the sort of old school Renaissance designer, Patrick. So his blog, False Machine, was something I just stumbled on. And it was a particular post on the blog. He had written about a book called The Art of Not Being Governed by an academic, James Scott. And the book is basically an ethnography of the Zomia region in sort of mainland Southeast Asia. It's a kind of like peripheral slash sort of like things are in flux there in the sense of in flux from the perspective of nation states. So it's kind of like a border sort of region or a mountainous region where the nation states that kind of claim that they have had trouble sort of administrating, because I mean, the idea of a nation state is fairly modern and fairly, you could argue, imperialistic, and the people of that region is just resistant for various reasons. Anyway, so like Patrick's post was reading this ethnography and sort of spinning game ideas out of like the details in the book. And that was the first time where I saw, hey, this is what games can be like. You know, they don't always have to be about sort of power fantasies or like this is the Star Wars RPG where I want to emulate a Star Wars protagonist or like a protagonist from my favorite sort of like pop culture sort of piece of media. This is making games out of stuff that aren't games or aren't sort of pop culture, or aren't sort of mediated in that sense. Yeah, I just found that sort of sense of eclecticism really inspiring. And it also helped that the book that Patrick was reading was kind of about Southeast Asia. And obviously I'm Southeast Asian. So yeah, that got me into the sort of old school sort of sub-community, and that got me writing sort of material just based on whatever it is that was in my context. Yeah, that's... Did that answer the question? Hello? Oops.
Oh, sorry. My mic was muted so that I didn't have any sounds come through. No, you definitely answered the question. I think those were beautiful answers. You gave us what the first game you sort of played was with your now colleague of Centaur Games. And you also told us the inspiration you had, which is an amazing inspiration for sure. And also that it opened you up to a different community so soon, specifically the OSR community, which is really cool. And that it also was a touch point for like your personal ethos of inspiration or fictional inspiration. And I think that's recently I've been really asking myself like, what is, because we have conversations on Twitter and on the internets about, like, what are we allowed to write? What are we allowed to explore when we come from different places? And I think a lot lately about, like, what is America's mythology? And I don't mean, like, what was its mythology before we colonialized it? I mean, like, what is it now? Like, do we have one? Is it sort of like the Jersey Devil? Is it the Sasquatch, right? Like, all those things, that all those, like, cryptids we talk about in America, is that our mythology? And so I think a lot about, how do I derive inspirations of mystical things from the current era of America, so that I'm not doing a bad job at other people's cultures.
Yeah, I mean, that's a subject matter that really interests me as well, because it's definitely something that me and Macau face when it comes to sort of our project, A Thousand Thousand Islands. Is kind of like a sort of zine series that's inspired by Southeast Asia. But, and in that sense, you know, like, we then have to sort of ask ourselves about the question of, no, we don't want to, we're not here to do, to represent Southeast Asia, because that's impossible. It's not even our place. Because any act of representation is kind of like stepping, at least for me, I feel fairly okay to say this, like, you only really represent yourself, and how much you can represent ends at where your skin ends. So yeah, it's really about, and so, like, navigating that sort of question, Mankau and I always return to this idea of, like, what are our interests, but also what are our lived realities. And so a lot of the stuff we make, granted, there's a fair bit of sort of research based work as well. Like, Mankau is a visual artist, and a lot of his images are created with lots and lots of, like, referencing and research about sort of material culture, like fabric fabric motifs and fabric. Fabric is a big deal in sort of the region, in sort of architectural, sort of like what curlicues did the houses have, like, what kind of wood carvings, all that stuff. But more than that, the zines are really, for example, one of our zines, which is kind of like a zine set in sort of a mountain kingdom and has a kind of like haunted mansion sort of feel to it. It literally comes from Mankau having a holiday in a sort of in a place called the Cameron Highlands, which is kind of a hill station holiday place, and in the rented bungalow where they were staying, his mother had sort of a dream about being sort of exsanguinated by ticks.
Wow.
So yeah, a lot of this comes from sort of like, so and if you've seen the zine is literally kind of about Mörkergur. Our crocodile zine comes from the fact that I live in a state called Nagrisembilan, and I get my water from a river called Sungai Linggi, and there are lots of saltwater crocodiles in that river. And you know that there's sort of stories that you hear as you're growing up, or that you read in sort of like sort of tabloid magazines about this family whose grandmother or great grandmother was a crocodile and frequently sort of possesses the sort of daughter of the family because she wants to visit the family. Yeah, so it's stories like that that kind of like ultimately inform the work. And so, like, the idea of, like, really just being specific. So, like, the question of, like, what is the American myth or the American... And I find that actually I use Patrick as an example for this too, because he made a book called Silent Titans, which is about his hometown in England, like, specifically. So a lot of the references in that game or in that sort of campaign setting are so Birkenhead specific that, and sort of like the myth of that particular region or that particular city. And ultimately that's what's really exciting. The specificity of a thing makes it exciting, makes it universal. So you don't have to you don't have to represent a region or a nation or anything. You only represent yourself, and that is the representation.
I think that feels so kind of freeing as you say it, because it's like what represents you and your experiences is so fascinating, because I think that is something that's sort of overlooked, especially in like trad fantasy games, when they're trying to include dragons and demons that have different like sort of connotations from different cultures and stuff like that, and gods, right? And I think it's so interesting that I could like, because I'm really interested in a modern fantasy, so I like sort of science fantasy settings, like Numenera is an example of a science fantasy setting. Mm-hmm. I like cities, but I don't like cyberpunk. I don't really like sci-fi. I like more like Magitek stuff. I'm a big Final Fantasy fan, and I really have been thinking about modern fantasy a ton, and that's a great insight, Zedek. That's a really good insight. And I also really love, like you were sort of mentioning, the inspirations for Moncal's like illustrations, especially as it relates to like fashion and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And specifically, as I was watching the Questing Beast video for, and this would be a great transitionary point to start talking about A Thousand Thousand Islands, but for the, let me pull it up real quick. Corvu, is that how you say that?
Yeah.
Corvu, the drowned or dry vassal of the sea, the sort of like headpieces, or even like the decapitated headpieces of all the, what is it, boat swains, all like the boat pieces that get to that is so, so cool. So very, very cool. And the living ships is just amazing. But you know, before any of that, could you just talk about a little bit of what the A Thousand Thousand Islands project is?
Okay, so A Thousand Thousand Islands started with Mankau, and he was, basically it was a reaction. He was reacting to the kind of Southeast Asian themed or Southeast Asian inspired sort of, I guess, pop culture or fantasy sort of stuff he was seeing at the time, which really felt to him as like, okay, this really doesn't feel Southeast Asian. It feels like someone's taken sort of Western fantasy tropes or wuxia tropes and redressed them, so reskinned them with sort of like a Malay warrior with a tonkolo and a kris. So it really, like, he wanted to do a thing, a project to sort of expand the sort of boundaries of his own imagination. So when he had this reaction, he thought about it and he realized that we really can't, at least talking to about ourselves, Mankau and I are Malaysian, and we can't, or we found that our conception of what Malaysian fantasy would look like was very narrow, because our relationship to our past or the image of our past has been so abridged because of, you know, part of the nationalist project is to have a sort of to mythologize and homogenize your nation's past. So to give the reason for the nation to be. So with Malaysia, for example, it's very much focused on a single sultanate called the Malaccan Sultanate. So it's Malay Muslim. It is all to do with the idea of this dashing Malay warrior with the kris and sort of, things like that. And so like he wanted to look at the sort of broader cultures that used to exist and still exist, but we don't really focus on the sort of Hindu-Buddhist pasts of the region. The sheer amount of diversity in terms of like how people dressed, what people ate, sort of cultural things like how people built their homes, how people lived in homes, all the kinds of gods and spirits that even in our lived reality is still very real for us, but we're just not used to thinking about it or being or paying attention to it. So anyway, that's when I get roped in, and then we decide, hey, we've got all this material, we've all got these cool stories and cool, like places that we've sort of dreamed up. What do we do with them? And then Marco and I decided that, hey, we like playing these RPG things, but also we like having these RPG books. So let's make these zines. And each 1,000 Island zine is an island, a town, a village, or a city, a sort of polity that is part of this wider sort of... We use the word porous fantasy a lot because...
And what does that mean?
So the idea is... And this sort of falls into the idea of like thinking about centers and peripheries. Southeast Asia, by its nomenclature, is a periphery. The term Southeast Asia is a name that American foreign policy gave us after the World War. And when you look and even when you look at like sort of fantasy settings, generally, like whether they're RPG or RPG settings or not, generally there's always a single city or a single culture which is basically the center of the world, and everything is written as a response or exception to that center. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to make a sort of series of zines with no center. So when you pick up one of the zines, they oftentimes are introduced by, you know, a person arriving there, but they will tend to have, they have a cast of characters, they have like random generators for places, for names, for foods. They always have a list of trade goods, but more important than that is the sort of perspective that they take, which is regardless of where you're from, the gods of this particular, from this particular zine or in this particular place are real. The sort of creation myths are real, even if they contribute other creation myths in other zines. So yeah, so Manka and I would say that it's our way of portraying the concept of this sort of mandala form, which is, in terms of at least politics in Southeast Asia, there used to be all these cities or sort of polities whose influence radiated outwards, as opposed to like the way we conventionally view the world now, which is with borders. So like there'd be a city here and a city there, and the communities between those cities so everything is a negotiation, because nobody can say, hey, you are within my borders, I own you. Mm-hmm. That's a long-winded question. There's a long-winded explanation of the way what we mean by porous. So the other thing is, so the 1,000 Islands will probably never have a map. If we do draw a map of the whole sort of all the places we've written about, it will probably not be definitive. And now, so our go-to way of generating, hey, if you want to play a game set in 1,000 Islands, take all your zines and throw them on the floor, and how they fall is how they are arranged, how these places relate to each other.
I thank you for answering both of those questions for me and for maybe the listeners who had a similar question. But one thing, first of all, I love the sense of like, the conceptual mandala you were talking about when it comes to different places or cultures or identities, and how those are sort of like the in-betweens or the negotiations of peoples from those kind of would be the centers, and then the sort of mixing would be the periphery, right? Did I misspeak?
No. I was just going to say that basically what we've been trying to do is to make every place its center, its own center.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I love that. I love that so much. And there was a GDC talk about settings, specifically micro settings was the term they were throwing around during that talk. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I'm so attracted to 1,000 Islands, both in concept and in execution, is that they fit this sort of like really interesting micro setting energy that I think gets overlooked in your more traditional fantasy games, where you have like a big sprawling map that's wide open. But if like you really take the pieces of the map, there's really only like five cities in this giant continent that someone made up.
And it also feels like
Oh, go ahead.
No, so it's interesting that so much of like sort of traditional fantasy settings are so reliant on maps. And I think it's telling because, I mean, maps were made by imperial powers so that they could better measure distances and so better administrate their sort of holdings. And so something that came up, so in the recent sort of iteration of Metatopia, Richard Ruin sort of got a bunch of us together to talk about this very same topic that you mentioned, the idea of micro settings and how that related to our work. And so something that came up during the course of our conversation, which I was really pleased with, was the observation that a sort of macro setting or this sort of traditional sort of map-based fantasy setting is a micro setting that doesn't know that or doesn't want to admit it. Because there is always, in the building of these worlds, there are always assumptions about how the cosmology works, which gods are gods and which gods are spirits. You know, like all those like little sort of judgment calls and assumptions that are kind of invisible. For example, I was also talking with in another podcast about this idea that Dungeons & Dragons, like from its very first bestiary, had this clear distinction between monsters and animals. So like animals are mundane, they are basically naturalistic, sort of empirically scientific animals, like basically mundane biological creatures. And monsters are these like eldritch things that can have magic or like turn your swords to rust or whatever. And the thing about it is that even if you're talking in the context of sort of European sort of mythos, that's not how animals were viewed. Like so much of animal folklore, like things to do with foxes or like how you would relate to bears, treat animals with such a sort of mystique. Folk stories are about how this animal has this particular magic. And because of where probably sort of Gary Gygax's assumptions about how the world works, Dungeons & Dragons as its bestiary sort of encodes can't tell an animal, a folk animal story. I mean, obviously you can sort of like change the rules basically because like everybody house rules Dungeons & Dragons. But that assumption, I thought it was interesting to see that assumption baked into what is basically, here are the abstract rules, the bones of the world, so to speak, which really doesn't reflect a widespread idea, but a specific assumption.
Often I think about how much we take for granted what our world, like the planet Earth, is like. Like I think constantly about lightning and how that is just like raw energy that forms in a cloud and shoots down to the surface. Like everyone's like, oh, like that's a thunderstorm. But like how truly mind-boggling and amazing is lightning, is a tornado, is like the ocean. Like and then when you talk about sort of how people viewed these animals as, or there are some cultures in the world who view animals as a more like have a more mystic quality to them, or a more maybe even eldritch quality to them, as we talk about the difference between a monster and a beast for the Gygaxian train of thought, it's like these trickster spirits or these spirits of strength or something like that. Like the comparison between a human being and a bear is insane. Like the difference in strength, the difference in size, the difference in like what they care about and how they feel about different things or what they represent to people is just like, there's so many different angles you could look at just a single animal on the planet. And even more so when you either A, put that animal in its environment and then view the environment as a piece of that animal, or even vice versa. And then if you were to do fiction and fantastically move the bear into a different, like, what does a desert bear look like, right? Like, that's so mystical. That's so, like, fascinating to me. And I think it's just, it's something that I don't think a lot of people think about, especially as it relates to, like, imperialism and colonialization and stuff like that, and nationalism, and how it sort of, like, erases those, or maybe erase isn't the right word, but it obfuscates,
yeah,
all those ideas. And it's something I constantly try to, like, unlock in my mind about how mystical Earth is by itself.
Yeah. And yeah, so, like, yeah, I guess that's what we're exploring. The idea that if every different place is it's its own center, then the way the world works changes from place to place. Mm-hmm. So the contradiction is part of the world. And Marco and I think about this a lot, because obviously, I guess, modern middle class Anglophone sort of, like, rational thinking people. But during Hungry Ghost Month, we're still careful when the sun goes down. You know what I mean? And it's not a question of whether or not ghosts exist. It really is a question of, like, does the ghost know that you think it doesn't exist? I remember this quote, and I often talk about it, even though I can't find the source. It was an interview with one of the sort of indigenous communities in East Malaysia. This community is now largely Christian because of sort of colonialism and sort of missionary work. But some of their sort of older, their elders remember and still practice the sort of, like, their sort of traditions. And it was an interesting quote because, oh, we are Christian now, but, like, during the Harvest Festival, we try not to spend the night in the longhouse, because the longhouse is full of spirits, and the spirits of our ancestors will probably be offended that we don't believe in them anymore. And I just found that, you know, that idea is so emblematic about how I relate to this context, for example. Like, that seeming contradiction is just the way I live. And that's the kind of thing that we are trying to present, I suppose, in our work.
What was the name of the event? The Hungry Ghosts?
So, Hungry Ghost Festival.
Hungry Ghost Festival, yes. Could you tell us about that? If you're open to it.
It's also called the seventh month, because that's when the seventh month of the sort of lunar calendar. So it's an East Asian sort of Chinese thing. And Manka and I both are ethnically Chinese. So yeah, during Hungry Ghost Month, if I'm not mistaken, the gates of hell open and basically, like, tormented spirits walk the earth. And you know, like, as a relative, you're meant to sort of, like, entertain them, keep them fed for this period of time. So a lot of Chinese communities would put on, like, sort of opera shows it's one of these things where they're sort of opera stage shows, and people would go to watch them, and then the few front rows are kept empty because that's where the ghosts would sit. Yeah, so it's just one of those things. Yeah,
I think it's cool. I think that's amazing. Wow. Thank you for sharing that.
It's just part of life.
Well, I don't know. I think when we talk about this conversation of creating all these centers of experiences, I think it's also, like, a piece of that is learning about those centers, center to center, learning about those centers, right? And then engaging in that conversation. So, like, while the thing to that particular center might feel mundane or just kind of like a, you know, a thing we do that's sort of like cyclical or habitual. I think for the other center, it's like, wow, that's
exactly.
And I'm not trying to blow smoke up anyone's ass. Like, I truly think that's amazing.
And that's the thing. Like, I understand what you're saying, and the reverse is also true. And that's why I was taken so much with Patrick's Silent Titans. And I'm sure if somebody from America would write about their sort of home city or hometown, there'd be these little details that would be like, wow, that would, as a person who's not from there, would be really sort of fire for the imagination.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, I mean, this might go back into like a conversation about like colonialism or imperialism, but do you think in this concept of a thousand islands, or even in the concept of like centers and peripheries, do you think the conversation of like learning about another center changes the center learning about it? Like, do you think that centers adjust over time as they experience other centers?
That's a complicated question. That's the thing. I think when sort of, at least in the sort of patchwork of the sort of Southeast Asian region before colonialism or even before the arrival of Islam. Yeah, I mean, like, take Southeast Asia in the colonial age when the white people arrived, they were just one of many, many players in the region. It was all this idea of like sort of the ancient capital of Thailand used to have a Japanese quarter and a Malay quarter. Like the sort of Filipino sailors Filipino mercenaries, warriors were hired throughout the region by different like kingdoms. So yeah, I mean like, there was, it's just trade in things and people and culture. Things were basically part, were essentially, again, we circle back to the idea of porousness. So the centers were porous in that, you know, like you might look different from you, but if you play, you might look different from us, but we are fairly different looking from each other. And I mean, stuff used to be basically feudal before nationalism, right? So if you paid homage to the local deity or the local king or the local power, it didn't matter really how you looked, because everybody was kind of weird, especially if you are in a kind of region like Southeast Asia where there were so many sea nomadic cultures, there was so much trade from India and China. And yeah, and I think to answer your question, the idea of centers only solidify much later when this is kind of related to Western imperialism and really the industrialization of imperialism. Because that's what colonialism was about. It was the industrialization of these push and pull of influence and power. Yeah, things, centers always change. They just became less open to change when they needed to industrialize.
So fascinating. Truly fascinating. I love this. I love like the scene of someone from one center visiting another center and sort of like paying respects that center's like ideologies or values, but in doing so are also able to maintain their identity as they visit, because you're merely just showing like, oh, cool. Like, I don't know. We, you know, everyone, this is from Monster Care Squad, so that's why it's in my head. But like, we trade like salts from our regions with each other. Like, that's our sign of like connecting with one another. And then beyond that, like, we are still our individual cultural representation, even if we're exploring a different space, and not in like a touristy way, but like almost in like an ambassador or. Like an ambassador sort of state.
I think in the absence of, because what really the arrival of the West brought to the region was the sense that there is a single cosmology. And absent of you go to a place and you visit the local temple of the local deity, because you would pay homage to that deity in the same way that you would pay homage to that king. When you go to a particular region of the jungle that has a tiger in it, you better be, you know, you got to reckon with the tiger there. Mm-hmm. Whether or not they're tigers where you live yourself is a different matter. But when you go to the tiger's home, you treat with the tiger. Mm-hmm. But also when you go visiting and you bring your gods with you because they are part of you. And I mean, the innovation of colonialism or sort of Western imperialism is to say that the world is a certain way, and wherever we go, it is the same. But absent of that, you really have every travel is an ambassadorship, like you say, it's a negotiation.
Mm. Wow. So with sort of that conversation of centers, what is your sort of favorite setting that you've created so far for A Thousand Thousand Islands?
Oh, God.
You have to pick. You have to pick one of your babies.
Oh, no. I guess I can pick a random. That makes it easier.
That's not an answer to the question. Random isn't favorite.
Well,
if it makes it easier, you can pick random. I'm just teasing.
So, okay. I mean, because it often is the case, which that the happily it is a case, and that's why Makau and I are enjoying the project so much, is that it often is that our latest completed zine is kind of like, oh, this is some cool shit. So the latest zine, that one of the zines that we put out like a few months ago, I mean our latest one, was a zine called 100 Red Scales. And I'm pretty pleased with that. So that zine is about an archipelago inhabited by monitor lizards. Basically, they're monitor lizards, but they are essentially the people of these islands. And the sort of humans, if you like human people who live there, adopt the sort of local culture, which is because monitor lizards don't make vocalizations, so their language is entirely gestural, and so like humans also like, yeah, if you talk, basically new arrivals are very obvious because they talk. That kind of marks you as a tourist. So yeah, I really liked the zine because, I mean, it's fresh in my mind, and also the sort of specific inspirations for it are pretty specific. So the sort of geography that's described within is sort of mangrovey and sort of island sort of mangrove-centric, muddy sort of roots, tangles of roots. And it's inspired by sort of trips both Manka and I took separately to a place called Langkawi in the north of Malaysia, which is a sort of island where a lot of these like limestone karst and sort of mangrove forests, and you go kayaking through it, and it's really quite strange and inspiring, I guess. Also, the monitor lizards of this place are weaving is sacred in this archipelago, and a lot of the sort of weaving traditions were inspired by things I saw in Lombok in Indonesia. So like my partner Sharon was in Lombok as part of a sort of a art project, and she worked with sort of traditional weavers in one of those communities, and I got to like sit and like watch them work. So yeah, I mean, like, just paying homage to, yeah. So I mean, I'm pretty pleased with that scene. Yeah,
it is very cool. I really love that it's almost like a sign language in a sort of way, which is really, really cool. And another like piece of that particular setting that I love are the NPCs or the sort of like presented figures in the book, like 20 Lake Claw and 13 Silk Bone. Those are just like, first of all, the drawings fucking ripping amazing. They're so good. Yeah, it's so detailed too. It's super detailed. Oh God, it's gorgeous. And just like another like really interesting piece that's a little bit more like on the game side of things, the tables are also really cool. I love the way that they're constructed and the bits that are that make up the results. Like I think you chose really interesting terms, languages, language, adjectives, like it all really sings character to the specific center, micro setting, whatever term we want to use here. Yeah, it's absolutely it's stunningly beautiful. It's so charming.
Thank you.
And
like you mentioned the sort of game design aspect of it. Like the zines obviously are system neutral or system agnostic, whichever term you prefer. That's primarily because Mankau and I are not really, at least in my own eyes, I don't see myself as a rules person. I don't really think in those terms. Like some people are really great at like making sort of elegant, abstract sort of this like interlocking systems that sing or whatever. And yeah, I just found, so for us, because Mankau's a visual artist and I'm a writer, text and art is also part of game design in the sense that, yeah, those tables are put together in a certain way. They're meant to lead. They are always created in the view of like, how would a player who is encountering this space or this creature or this, and creature and character are interchangeable often in the scenes. How would they react to this person or entity or place? What about that aspect might hook me if I encountered this thing for real? How would this particular combination of results, if you roll them, create hooky character, I guess is the word? Yeah, so that's my excuse for writing system neutral stuff. What are the bones of a good story or what are the bones of a sort of situation that might go somewhere? That's always in our minds when we make the images or the text.
Yeah, there's a term that's like floating around in my mind as you sort of talk about that is like, what is the sort of, someone might use the term like inciting incident, someone might use the term of like conflict, but I really think maybe something a little bit more evocative for me in this moment as I'm searching my mind is I watched some like drawing lessons on YouTube and stuff, and my partner is a visual artist, and one of the things that I find really fascinating when it comes to character design is gesture. And how gesture is the sort of like vocab word for like movement or being in a space and how you present that in a 2D way. So as you sort of like talk about this, I think about like, well, then what is the gesture of any particular NPC or story or setting? Like what is the movement? Yeah. How does it operate in its space on a narrative level? And I think, I just think that concept now in my mind is really, really fascinating, the gesture of narrative.
And the thing about communicating that kind of detail is it's not just about sort of, it's not, doesn't only serve the sort of narrative or the sort of this, I mean the shared creation of narrative in the RPG, but also in the sort of more practical, like how do you run this character? How do you portray it if you are the GM or if you are the character who's playing the player who's playing that character? So something about like the zines are very, very, the zines are relatively light on text, and the drawings are so detailed because, and that's by design because.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
So, like, there's a lot of context orientation that is going on with the images, because Southeast Asia is not a very familiar sort of vocabulary of imagination or mm-hmm. or gesture, as you put it, in terms of like the way people dress, how people behave, the fact that nobody wears shoes. But that sort of stuff is kind of signaled almost on a subconscious level, because you basically look at the image of the character and you kind of get how you might be able to play this and what the sort mm-hmm. of cues of the culture are about. I remember Amanda Frank sort of saying that when she ran A Thousand Islands for her home group, it was really like whenever people were kind of confused about how something would look or like they had trouble imagining this character, she just showed them the zine and they like, that's how it looks. And because it's not impressionistic, sort of Mankau's drawings give so much information in terms of like the textile culture and the sort of the way the masks look and the way how this lizard is dancing with the mask. You kind of, so that sort of orientation is done for you.
Mm-hmm. It's so fascinating. Now I'm thinking about like narrative with like visual art terms. Mm-hmm. My mind's exploding, but that's another podcast for another day. With that, I would like to allow you the opportunity to sort of talk about the Kickstarter that's coming up. Yes. Would you just give a brief introduction for maybe someone who's not familiar about Reach of the Roach God and sort of walk us through like what that project has been like so far?
So, Reach of a Roach God, it will be part of A Thousand Thousand Islands. Mm-hmm. It will be our first book-length work. So, the zines in A Thousand Islands have all been zines, so they're fairly short, 40 pages. This one will be a full-length hardcover. It will also be our first adventure book.
Ooh.
So basically, the zines have all been... I mean, they all have adventure sort of like... seeds and random generators. You could create adventures in them. But so Reach of the Roach God will have basically three fully formed adventures, hex crawls, or like cave crawls. The the book is themed around caves. Southeast Asia has a lot of these huge cave complexes, and yeah, I mean like they're like. Manka and I have been in not many, but even just one makes you creeped out and sort of odd in the same light. So like we really want to communicate them. So yeah, there'll be three adventures. They'll all push you underground. The book will also have three essentially zine, similar to our zines, three gazetteers of like cultures that exist in this sort of underworld. I've been sort of telling people that this is kind of our take on an Underdark book, like a D&D Underdark book. And yes, you there'll be roaches because caves are full of roaches. And Manka and I both hate roaches. fear roaches more is probably the more accurate word. And with this, we just decided to tack into our fear. We're still working on it. So really the Kickstart is a way to sort of sustain ourselves as we work on the book length, because it will take a while and we can't work on any more zines while we're working on the book. So it really makes sense. Fundraising as opposed to like a pre-order. This is fundraising our livelihoods for the next few months as we finish this thing.
That's amazing. And exciting, truly. I think, again, like both you and Mungkow's imaginations and touch points they feel very unique in a very cool way. At least, to me, as one center to another center, in that, you know, when you say it out loud, it seems so obvious. Like, of course, roaches in caves, that's fucking easy sauce. But like, I've never put two and two together, because at least for us, like, I guess roaches live in sewers here in America and things like that, and those are technically cave systems, but oftentimes we see them in houses that have gone kind of like defunct or abandoned, and they're eating sort of like the leftover organic materials. And that's like, it's more like they feel like infestations rather than putting them in a place of ecosystem. For yours, it, like, to me, it feels very ecosystem. It feels like this is where, like, this is their home, this is where they reside. But for us, it's like they're invading our homes, and it feels very like alien and things of that nature.
Roaches are filthy and vicious, and like sort of like they are voracious cannibals and all these other things. So that the emphasis on infestation has a grounding, but the thing about it is that a lot of things from the natural world are just mean and gross, but also part of researching the book. And both Manka and I have talked about this separately. It's like we now constantly have tabs open linked to gross things. Like really, like, how do roach mouth parts work? What does roach blood taste like?
Absolutely not.
But the interesting thing about making a piece of work about the subject is that then I don't want to say that you kind of humanize a gross thing, but you sort of familiarize yourself with it. So I started, so because I'm more aware of the idea of roaches, I started noticing that, like, my partner and I have been composting quite intensively in our garden, we're basically trying to grow vegetables. And we found, like, in those piles of compost, it's full of roaches. They maybe don't look like the ones that live in the house and eat people food, but they are still roaches, and they don't trigger my phobias because they look kind of beetle-like, more closer to beetles. They're slightly smaller. They're more black than sort of caramel colored, and like they still move the same way, but seeing different aspects of this is, like, I guess personally is the most interesting thing about it. Like, I don't want to say I like roaches now, but I just see more of them, which is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also, I think it again goes back to that like ecosystem thing of like you said, this last story was about like the composting of it, right? For us, typically in the American suburb, we rely a lot on worms to do the work that roaches are doing for you when it comes to compost piles. And so it just, again, like, sort of like maybe calms me down in terms of, you know, attributing this thing specifically to infestation. Like, that is what, like, it is sort of like diseasey or virusy or something like that. But that's not necessarily what's going on here. It's just like these roaches
their ecosystem are our defunct houses and all the like organic material that lives inside of them. And we're as much like, you know, we eat meat and stuff too. So we're just as gross roaches and in lots of ways grosser because we're destroying the whole planet. Again, another podcast for another day.
I often write, so like the roach god, the titular roach god of Reach of the Roach God is kind of, it's basically an antagonistic figure, and most of my villains are stand-ins for like sort of imperialist or oligarchs anyway, so that idea that we are destroying the world with our hunger is very much part of the metaphor of the roach god.
Metaphor, it's a truth, my friend. It's absolute truth. there's no allegory here. Wow, it sounds so cool. It sounds so fantastical, but it feels very grounded in its source material, and thus gives it more verisimilitude.
I found it.
Verisimilitude in terms of like its realism or its immersion in its center. And I think it sounds so crushingly easy to succeed. I don't know why it would. it just seems so amazing.
We're pretty nervous about it because it's our first campaign.
Mm-hmm. And,
it is kind of hard to sort of run a campaign from this region.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we hope it. God, we really hope it works out.
I want to work out for you, and that's why, you know, that's part of the reason why we're doing this today. So we inform the people about what's going on so that they can get acclimated to spending dollars on the game. Do you have a follow page up for Reach of the Roach?
We've got a bit.ly/ROTRG sort of link. But yeah, I mean, like, I'll drop it in the show notes or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Those will definitely be available for you listeners to make sure to go get that notification for when the Kickstarter goes live. DYD funded, baby.
It's going live November 9th, I think. So pretty soon.
So soon. Oh my God. Well, that means I'm going to have to turn this episode around then. I'm going to have to get it edited and out there as soon as possible. Do you have any favorite pieces? Is it the Roach God? Is it sort of like the environment you've put the Roach God in? What's your favorite piece of the Kickstarter so far in its conception?
Oh, gosh.
If you have to pick randomly again, that's okay.
In the making of things, I rarely feel... I always feel like, oh, I hate these. I hate this. Like, it's always a... In progress of making a thing, it's always a process of like, oh, I hate this. I'm embarrassed with this. This is so boring. This is not going to work. So it's more of like, I don't know which one I dislike the least. But
I relate, my dude. I relate.
Yeah. It's hard, isn't it? Like, I hate it.
Take your time.
So actually, this will be part of the preview, the adventure that we will have as a preview for the campaign. So it basically is, it's kind of a playtest kit in the sense that here's one of the adventures in a sort of roughly laid out in a PDF with art, and run it and I guess tell us what you think or whatever. But I mean, the roaches in that particular adventure, I feel quite pleased with, because so they're sort of the main, this the sort of leader of that particular group of roaches is a centipede roach, in the sense that it's a roach but also a centipede. Yeah, in the sense of it's a bunch of roaches strung into a long line, and she.
Oh God!
And the I mean, it's very easy to write them as this is a monstrous thing, and it's really gross, and yeah, sure, like the roaches are kind of mean, like kind of they're basically stealing goats from the local community, like spreading disease and whatnot. But the idea is that she's a she's an apostate to the Roach God. So she's one of his daughters, but she has left. And she is looking for a different way to be. Or she's looking to found her own kingdom. So she's looking for a different model of being a queen, of like having a kingdom, leading a people. And I thought that was an interesting thing to include because, yeah, you get these obviously monstrous antagonists, but should you take the time to talk to her and sort of like, and I mean, you're not going to instantly sort of convert her into like, oh, the nobility of like egalitarianism, but it is... I just found the idea of like having a sort of philosophical discussion about the way societies work with an enormous roach centipede really an interesting sort of image. That's one of the things that is possible in one of our adventures.
Well, if you all want that and more, you're going and. I do. It sounds so amazing. Then you need to, you know, get your notifications on, get your wallets ready.
It's not the most charismatic of creatures, roaches, but we hope
it doesn't matter. It doesn't. It's not about charisma. It's about gesture.
Okay.
It's
about gesture. Yeah. It's about.
With that, Zedek, I think that we are going to close out the show here, being at the top of almost our 90 minutes. Would you just give a brief outro once again of who you are, where people can find you, and any links you want to point them towards? Any of these things will be down below in the show notes for your access listeners.
Okay. Once again, I'm Zedek Siu. I'm a writer, designer, translator, editor from Port Dickson, Malaysia. And I'm one half of A Thousand Islands. And our first book, Reach of the Roach God, will be on Kickstarter soon. Find me at ZXU on Twitter and A Thousand Islands.com.
Amazing. Thank you. Well, thank you, Zedek, for being on here. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Zedek, because I learned a lot about myself and roaches today and so much more.
Thank you. And I mean, like, you're welcome.
And we will see you next time. Say bye to the people, Zedek.
Bye.
Bye. All right, that's a wrap. Thank you for taking the time to sit down and hang out with Zedek and I. We really appreciate it. You can find links and resources down below in the show notes, such as getting in touch with Zedek or other episodes with similar topics. If you want to be a part of the conversation, please come and join the community Discord server. Also, make sure to subscribe to the Draw Your Dice Patreon, where you can get access to early releases of episodes from as soon as we interview. Thanks again for stopping by, and as always, I will catch you next time.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.